Without any firm plans, and only some old family contacts, 42-year-old Rupert Murdoch, an Australian publishing entrepreneur, relocated to Britain. Not the most savory one either. Reports of the Page 3 bare-breasted pin-ups in his London newspaper precede him. Starts traveling regularly to New York in 1973, looking for business opportunities. He cuts a certain 60s-ish figure, the pretty slick media executive, with his double-breasted blazer, longish dark hair starting to thin, the beginnings of a 70s comb-over. A frequent cigarette, he'll stop smoking within the year. And satisfied, plumpish figure, he's more the Madison Avenue or Mayfair type, an artful combination of diffidence and intensity, then a casual or scruffy Fleet Street guy. His father was the most powerful newspaper publisher in Australia. Some 20 years after Sir Keith Murdoch's death, his son had made his own name. In Australia, he's almost as famous as his father was, and has now branched out, aggressively and noisily, to the United Kingdom. But if he's known for anything in the United States, it's the 2 years before, in London, he was the main character in a bizarre incident that got international attention. He's the rich guy whose wife was targeted by kidnappers, who instead snatched and then murdered the wife of one of his executives, who'd had the misfortune of borrowing the Murdoch family car, a Rolls-Royce, which added nicely to the story. He's the disreputable tabloid publisher at the heart of a macabre tabloid tale. The subtext of the kidnapping, as it's been reported in the London papers, is that it surely has something to do with, and confirms, his notorious character. Not to mention what it says about the perils of working for him. That's Murdoch. He's shady and alarming and dangerous. So New York, in addition to its business potential, is something of an escape from what the Brits feel for him, and he for them. New York, he senses, is his kind of town, a place where he'll be more welcomed than disdained for his bit of notoriety. He's a workaholic when this is not yet a popular thing to be. He's got no friends, has really never had any. Too busy, to tell you the truth, he will explain decades later in one of our interviews. At the age of 75, he'll say to his third wife, Wendy Murdoch, when she presses him on the issue, that he could have had them if he wanted to. He has no interests outside of his work, not sport. He may be the only Australian man not interested in sports, not culture, not reading, not movies. He has no social aspirations either. Money itself isn't even that compelling to him. He's eerie or scary in his lack of lifestyle desires and need for approval. There's almost a sort of autism or fanaticism to his focus. He's a new sort of business guy, married to the business, as he will characterize himself many years later, not without some ruefulness. Working isn't the means to an end. It's the end. It's one man's war, a relentless, nasty, inch-by-inch campaign. For the past 20 years, he's been focused almost solely on newspapers. He perhaps knows as much about the various aspects of putting out a newspaper, paper, printing, distribution, advertising, reporting, editing, headline writing, promotion, as anyone in the world. When he hasn't been working at one of his papers, Aid in Australia, as much as 2,000 miles apart, two more, 25 hours away in London, he's been traveling between them. It's a kind of monomania that, from an early age, fascinates and disturbs other people. He's aloof, contained, preoccupied. Shyness, Simon Jenkins, a former editor of Murdoch's Times of London, will write in his 1986 study of newspaper owners, is a characteristic shared by most second-generation proprietors growing up under dominant fathers. In 1984, Harry Evans, another editor of the Times, whom Murdoch would rancorously fire, will recall the Rupert he first met in 1969 as being socially crippled by shyness. He shuffled, smiled, and left sentences in midair. He seemed too diffident to be a tycoon and too inarticulate to be a journalist. This was as appealing as it was surprising. Still, he can be disarming, if he cares to. He's not a great conversationalist, but he's a decent listener. He can even appear to be self-effacing, though this would hardly be the case. He asks good questions, and he's witty in an understated way. It's a sort of hangman's wit. He's most entertaining and caustic on the subject of other people's lapses, losses, and screw-ups. He's a good gossip. He'll offer information, and he's appreciative of the information you give him. He's hungry for it, often rewarding the people who give it to him with sudden, surprising openness and easy, almost giggling laughter. On the other hand, he's often disconcertingly direct or abrupt, cutting to the chase, breaking the social flow. It's a tic. It's unsocialized, lacking any depth of self-awareness, and being impatient with what that implies. He's not all that interesting when it comes to talking about himself. He can't tell you why he does what he does, and has never been all that interested in the question. But he can be trenchant about other people. He's got a snap sense of their weaknesses. He can apply this to their spouses, their bank accounts, their ambitions. He's an expert on overreaching. He's always filing away telling or damaging personal details.